What's up, everybody? You are listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I'm Tom Hush.
I'm Amakanda Cornelius.
And we are so glad to be back with you. I was thrown off a little bit by the Spanish.
Yeah.
I always forget that you studied Spanish in college.
Yeah, I tried to bust out a little bit. I feel like the accent could use a little bit of work, so
sure.
I wanted to dust it off for a sec.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, back again for another week. We've got a great show lined up for you today. In our feature presentation segment a little bit later, we talk to Mari Ulrich, and she is a fantastic writer and director, and she's got a couple of works up on Amazon Prime. One is called Faster, and that's a short, and the other one is called The Alley Cat, and they both deal with the same character who is a bike messenger, but in two very different ways. So we're very excited to talk to her a little bit later. I think we're gonna have a good time with that one.
Yeah, it's going to be a good show.
And after that, we're going to talk a little bit about this Newsweek article that we both found decrying, I mean, really in a very emphatic way.
Yeah, it's insane. It's a little raving, I think.
Yeah, a raving mad article.
A raving madman is
writing about the lack of classic movies on Netflix. And I think we have a few thoughts on that. So we'll get to that a little bit later in our post credits. But for right now, it is time for news. All right. So, Connor, we're going to start things off with a box office report. Why don't you start us off?
So, we are recording this before all of the weekend statistics are in.
Yeah. It's Saturday right now. You're going to be hearing this on Monday, or at least we're releasing this on Monday. So, we don't have the Friday numbers in, but we do have our Thursday going into Friday, and we have the Friday like preview, the Friday expectation. So,
and there are a few notable things that deserve to be spoken about. It, which we talked about at length last week, has officially toppled The Exorcist for the highest grossing horror film of all time, accumulating over $60 million.
Do you know if that's adjusted for inflation?
It's not adjusted for inflation yet, but I mean, it is just gross, overall gross.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I feel like in terms of inflation, The Exorcist must be, like, astronomically more successful.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think The Exorcist is a much better movie than the new It.
That is, I will agree on that.
Yeah.
I will tip my hat to that.
But that is to say, this is an R-rated film about a clown that's killing kids.
Yes.
And it's done better than, you know, basically a classic.
Yeah. That is, which is strange to really think about. And we compare movies a lot. It's hard not to. You know, when you're talking about anything, eventually you're going to compare and contrast. And while it would be hard to say that quality-wise it is the same as The Exorcist, I think the response to it has been similar in terms of this event sort of feel to it. You know what I mean, Connor?
Yeah. Well, I guess a large part of it is there's sort of a new Stephen King renaissance going on right now.
Absolutely.
You've got The Dark Tower. You've got a few new miniseries of his coming up.
Mm-hmm. A lot of that brought back by, as Kate Nibbs from The Ringer said last week, this renewed interest in the 80s, and like Stranger Things really brought it back. And I remember when It came out, a lot of people were, I love that Tim Curry one. Oh, it scared me so much as a kid. And that's what brought them out to go see it. Now, in terms of quality, definitely a rough debate there. But I don't know. I'm glad that we've had a horror hit. I'm glad that September is looking up in terms of box office numbers. August was the worst one in 20 years.
Yep.
That which is mind-blowing to me. But you know what? There's been a complete dearth of really great movies, or at least movies that seem to hit the zeitgeist. And Stephen King's It appears to be that movie for September. So congratulations, Andy Muschietti.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the correct way to say his name. Like,
I think there might be a shh.
Is it Muschietti?
I think it might be Muschietti.
I'm going to go with Muschietti.
Muschietti.
And I believe his sister was like a producer, was one of the producers on it.
I did see that in the opening.
Yeah, the Muschiettis are like
they're growing.
Unit.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Muschiettis are on the attack.
The Muschiettis are on the rise.
All right, what's else is going on with the box office?
So if you needed further proof that tired concepts still sell well, American Assassin is in second place at 14 million. I think that opened last weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's going into, that's our Thursday number for that. Really?
Yep.
I definitely can't believe that, but I guess, you know, it's like a Tom Clancy-esque thing. People are going to be into it, I suppose.
Yeah. And Michael Keaton's pretty hot right now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm surprised that this was going to be his next project.
Yeah.
I mean, overall, he did Birdman, which I loved. I was really glad that he did Birdman. And then Spider-Man, okay, but, like, still going with this kind of superhero thing, getting in on that Marvel money.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody wants a piece of the Marvel money. And then American Assassin.
It's sort of, yeah. Why?
Typical. And now, I have not seen the movie, but as many of you know, I do work in a movie theater, and I catch a little bit of every movie that we show, and American Assassin looks like the most cookie cutter like bullshit and is also incredibly violent. I know it's rated R,
yeah,
but there is a scene where like he's Dylan O'Brien is sneaking into a house or something to shoot a terrorist, I presume, because, you know, America. And
that's what American assassins do.
That's what American assassins do. They shoot terrorists.
And are absolutely in no way terrorists themselves.
It hurts. But,
yeah, that hurt.
But he sneaks into this house and he sneaks up on, like, there's this, the terrorist and his, you know, gorgeous escort, and she, like, sees him, and the terrorist security detail tries to shoot Dylan O'Brien and just guns down this woman in cold blood. Like, she's just screaming and then just, like, AR-15 to the face.
Wow.
And I was, like, really disturbed. I'm like, I don't like this. This really did not make me want to see the rest of this movie.
Out of context, especially.
Oh, yeah. And there's another scene where a woman literally, like, takes a gun and shoots herself in the head.
Really?
Yeah, she's just like, I want to see my family. And like, there's this weird standoff between Dylan O'Brien and the dude who played Gambit in X-Men Origins, Taylor Kitsch.
Nice pull.
Yeah, I think Taylor Kitsch from Friday Night Lights. Tim Riggins from Friday Night Lights.
Jesus.
And he's like, you know, they have this weird standoff. I have no context for it, so I'll admit to that. And then she's just like, I want to see my family again, and pulls a pistol and just blows her brains out on screen.
Oh my God.
For seemingly no reason, but I'm sure there's some sort of script justification. But anyway, the point being,
who directed this?
I don't even know. I don't want to know.
Was it a woman?
Honestly, I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not rule it out. Let's not be that type of show. I'm sure a woman could have easily directed it, but we're gonna go to the Noco Cinema supercomputer here because why not. Directed by Michael Cuesta, who has done some directing for 6 Feet Under, Dexter, Blue Bloods, and Homeland. So history of violence, as it were.
I wonder what the choice is for that. It is interesting talking about these scenes out of context, not really knowing the greater narrative, but
because women getting killed on screen is kind of like par for the course, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. It's like, what was he thinking?
It didn't even seem like there was some sort of narrative decision to do it. Like, they kill off that terrorist girlfriend just because, oh, she's in the way.
Yeah. It sounds just like, oh, you know, it'd be really cold-blooded. Just killing somebody for no reason and then just introducing a character and then just...
Human debasement.
Shout out to Alien vs. Predator Requiem.
Shout out.
Ultimate human debasement.
What's next on the list? What were we looking at Thursday?
So, sort of a departure from the previous two, a movie that's been extremely polarizing for audiences, Darren Aronofsky's new film, Mother, with Jennifer Lawrence.
Exclamation point.
Mother. Mother.
Mother!
Okay, yeah. There you go. And it's at over $7 million, which produced by Paramount, which is a little bit of a disappointment, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that, why it's a disappointment later. But it is in third place at the moment, and it also has received a, in certain circles, coveted F from nationwide survey group CinemaScore.
Yes. This has been the story of the moment with Mother, is that they received the coveted F from CinemaScore. Now, it is very rare that a movie gets an F.
How does somebody get an F on CinemaScore?
So, for those of you who don't know what CinemaScore is, it is a survey, basically, that there are many teams, usually about 35 to 45 teams, that go out to some of the largest cities in America for an opening weekend of a movie. And five cities are picked at random. And you get one of these teams, they go to these cities, and they, you know, when you're walking out of the theater, they give you a scorecard that you can opt in to take. And you rate the film on A plus to F. You say whether or not you're going to buy it, you know, buy it or rent it on DVD or Blu-ray. And you also give a reason why you came to see the movie, just so that they can get a sense of who's coming to see this film. And it looks like Mother was a completely alienating film for most of the general public, to the point where they would just not want to ever see it again. No rentals. They're just like, I came to see this because the marketing made it look one way and it turned out to be something completely different, which is interesting. I've seen Mother. Connor has not seen Mother.
I have not.
I definitely understand the CinemaScore of F. Like, it is an incredibly polarizing film. I have still not really decided how I ultimately feel about it. I'm still brewing, you know, my thoughts. I'm probably going to see it again before I actually know how I feel about it. But I just gotta say, I think it's worth a watch.
Yeah.
If for nothing, just but like the conversation of trying to figure out how you feel about this film. Is the allegory too strong? I would suggest ignoring, like, do not listen to any interviews from Darren Aronofsky, Jennifer Lawrence, any of them.
Yeah.
Because they are, like, trying to justify this movie, and that's a bad idea. I wholeheartedly reject people trying to, like, tell you what a movie like Mother is about, because all that really matters is what you feel about it. So if you go and see Mother and you hate it and you have valid reason for it, like, just accept that. Don't worry about what Darren Aronofsky has to tell you about the concept of Mother. Just go see it. And if you love it, accept that and be like, oh, you know, it could be about this, could be about that. Enjoy the process of figuring it out for yourself.
And I have not seen it, and I haven't read any reviews by it, but I have seen a lot of news about how, you know, obviously how difficult it has been for audiences to, like, deal with this movie. And I do have to say, being a, I don't know, fan of Darren Aronofsky, it does not surprise me in the least. Anybody that is familiar with his films like Black Swan or Requiem for a Dream, this person seems to make movies which are pie, which are made to make you feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And elicit just a very challenging reaction from the people that watch his films.
Yeah, that's actually been his largest critique from a lot of people, is that they feel that the shock is for shock's sake.
Yeah.
There are some, and I was reading a recent bit in the New York Times where it's just, you know, readers reacting to Mother because it is such a polarizing film. They were, you know, just giving their thoughts on it. And one of the most important ones was, this guy was looking back into Black Swan, looking at Requiem for a Dream. He's just like, Darren Aronofsky is just shock for shock's sake. He's not really saying anything with it. Now, I think that's up for debate, especially in some of his better films like Black Swan, like Pi, like The Wrestler. I think a lot of people forget that he did The Wrestler, and I think The Wrestler is probably the best movie he's made, because it doesn't have that same shock factor, or at least he brings it back a little bit. But many people who have seen Requiem for a Dream, that movie is legendary for its final, like, 10-15 minutes.
That
it's insane. I can't even watch that movie a lot. Like, I can watch it once a year, maybe. It gets to me, and whether or not it's pretentious or pandering or schlocky, I don't know. I just kind of react to his movies on a visceral level, and maybe that's just the point. It's, you know, maybe if you try to think too much about it, it does fall apart. But yeah. I will say Mother looks great in terms of its cinematography. It's shot on like Super 16. So it's got this awesome like film grain to it. All the shots are really tight and claustrophobic. So at the very least, it's an interesting film. Whether you like it or not, it's up to you. But it's an interesting film. And shout out, you know, a good job getting a cinema score of F.
Yeah,
maybe
good work, Darren.
Better that we have more movies that are willing to push the envelope for better or for worse.
Yeah, taking risks.
Taking risks.
Speaking of risks.
Risks.
This comes to us from The Hollywood Reporter. Pamela Rolfe wrote an article about, we're going to go global for a second,
mm-hmm.
wrote an article about a recent move on behalf of the Spanish government to make it a little bit easier for Spanish people to go to the cinema.
I love this.
So we're talking Spanish movie ticket sales tax here. They're lowering the movie ticket sales tax from 21%, which was the highest in Europe, and they're lowering it a full 11% down to 10%, which is a request that the film industry in Spain has been championing for the last 6 years. And like I said, they had the highest ticket sales tax in Europe, and Spain has had a rough go in the last decade or so.
Absolutely.
They had a financial crisis in 2008, and it was difficult, especially for the film industry, because several other sectors saw a reduced tax rate, and the film industry's only went up, and it just skyrocketed to be the highest in Europe. So the government has sort of come forth and said, provided some justification for the move, and now they're saying that they're forecasting a $7 million drop with this reduced rate, which, by the way, is going to drop ticket prices to 72 cents. Which, if you're familiar...
Is it dropping it to 72 cents, or is it dropping it 72 cents?
It's dropping the sales tax from, I believe it was 93 cents to 72 cents.
Okay.
So the sales tax on the tickets is going to be there, and that's going to come out to about a $7 million deficit for the government in terms of their previous profit mm-hmm. they were getting. And they've also said that they inherited near-bankrupt finances from the previous government and had to find funds where they could.
Yeah, I think understandably the increased tax on a leisure thing kind of makes sense from a political perspective. You know, 2008 was a crazy year all across the globe, and Spain was hit super hard. And keeping that that tax there to increase, to have, you know, even a, you know, an extra $7 million, or sorry, is 7 million euros, I guess, in the bank is good. But what a ridiculous sales tax.
Yeah.
21%. And we think our tickets are bad.
Exactly.
At least the taxes are not massive on that. And that's just fascinating that that's how they found the money, was like in the movie industry.
Yeah.
Well, especially in America, when we keep thinking like, oh, no one goes to the cinema anymore. Well, they manage, you know, in Spain, they managed to find a lot of extra money just off of people going to the cinema. So that's an interesting thing. And you know what? They've got a film festival coming up in Spain. So I'm sure this is a good time to unveil this new tax reduction.
It probably feels like they're inaugurating it in a way.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Now, I want to move on to a story from Inside Hollywood concerning Mr. J.J. Abrams and the embattled Paramount studio. Take it away, Connor.
So, J.J. Abrams, if you're familiar with the man.
Who?
Yeah.
J.J. Abrams?
I think he was the producer on like a Cloverfield film or something.
Yeah, he may have. He invented lens flare.
Oh, that's what he did. Man, I love that lens flare.
Yeah.
I got to say,
he invented the sun so that we could have lens flare.
Thanks, J.J. Abrams. So, so if you've been paying attention to what's going on in the studio world today, you would know that Paramount Pictures could use a win. And we just talked at length a little bit about Mother, which is a Paramount film, and it's not doing as well as they had hoped.
No, far from it.
Far from it, my friends. So the CEO of Paramount, Jim Giannopoulos, has taken over the company in April from the previous CEO and has not had the easiest go of running the show. And J.J. Abrams is by far their shine, their knight in shining armor in terms of director, writer, producers.
Yeah, he's their wunderkind. He's really the one that they're depending on.
And he signed a deal in 2006, which a lot of people are looking at this and they're saying it might be the last of its kind. It's he gets $10 million a year in overhead and development, and they give him this every single year, and he isn't going to be able to work for Paramount. He hasn't made a film for them since 2013, Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah.
And Abrams has now been brought on to film the 10th Star Wars film. So
ninth.
Oh, the 9th Star Wars film.
God damn it.
All right, start the episode over.
So J.J. Abrams has this deal where he gets $10 million a year.
From Paramount
in overhead for production.
Yeah.
He doesn't keep that. That's just like...
That's just what they give. That's what the base amount that they'll give him.
Yeah. But he hasn't even made a movie for them since 2013.
Yep.
Jesus.
And he won't until past 2019, which is when his contract ends up. Goes, yeah. Expires.
They're not going to renew him.
You don't think so?
Well, I can't imagine they would. Like, I think it would be a dumb decision. Like, clearly, the House of Mouse has their grip on him. They're just like, if J.J. Abrams, he got the chance to do The Force Awakens, and I figured he would just do that. I think there was mostly indication that he would just do that. But clearly, he's willing to just turn around and do whatever seems more, I don't know, prestigious.
That's fair.
I like
he hasn't done bad for Paramount though.
No, I mean he did the two Star Treks.
Super 8.
He was Super 8 was okay.
I think between the two Star Trek movies and Super 8, they got about $267 million out of that global box office, which is not unsuccessful. And then
it's not unsuccessful.
Also
but...
produced 3 Mission Impossibles. He produced a 3rd Star Trek film and 2 Cloverfield films with another one.
Okay. So he's still doing stuff.
His worth for Paramount is over $5 billion.
Yeah.
In terms of global box office since he started working for them in 2006.
But I do feel the fear though that he would just turn around and be like, "Well, you know, they're asking me to do another Star Wars spin-off film."
Exactly.
Looks like I'm not going to produce or write or direct anything for you for the next year. Like, and how many times can that happen before they're just like, "Screw this." But yeah, that deal is ridiculous. If they do renew his contract, they got to like change that up. They either need to pin him down and be like, "You need to make us some movies, man. Like, we're giving you $10 million a year and over." I'm sure some of that is salary.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, if he's on their payroll, like, he should be doing... I'm sure they're getting him to do little things that we don't even know about. Hollywood's a weird place. Like, you know, Carrie Fisher was secretly a script doctor on so much stuff. People would just give her the script, and she'd doctor it. Like, you know,
That's
he could be doing a lot of stuff that we would never hear about.
Yeah, I mean, he's a bankable director, producer, and writer.
I guess.
Yeah.
I've never been, like, the biggest fan of J.J.
You can't deny he's bankable.
He's bankable, but, like, I don't like to hear that J.J. Abrams basically gets to do whatever he wants. He's kind of up in that echelon of, like, Joss Whedon, like, untouchable nerd icons that I don't really like. I don't like when people reach that level. And
like they want to put him in the pantheon with Spielberg.
Which... Sure. Well, he sure as shit wishes he was Spielberg. Like,
oh, yeah.
I don't know if you saw Super 8, but that
well,
was
he
basically
owes everything. To...
He owes everything to Spielberg.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess I don't know.
But I feel like the hardest position for everybody out of everybody involved in this, J.J. Abrams got a pretty sweet deal. But CEO of Paramount, Jim Giannopoulos.
I can't imagine being him right now.
No.
Paramount is not doing well.
Because you can't pull a power play where you just be like, "No, JJ, here's $10 million, here's $50 million, and you make this movie." Like, that could be disastrous.
Yeah, JJ could easily just be like, "No, I don't give a shit. People will come see anything I make." Like, he's JJ Abrams, unfortunately.
Yeah, and then if you decry JJ Abrams or Disney's choice to basically competitively poach the man, you're putting yourself against one of Hollywood's biggest directors right now. And then, like, Disney, the overlords of the American zeitgeist.
Yeah.
Like,
That is a tricky position to be in. Like we said, we would not want to be in the boardroom of Paramount right now, yeah, because especially with Mother, they really invested. They were really hoping that was going to be like the talk about. It is one of the most talked about films of the year, but not for the best possible reason.
Yeah, good on paper. That's for sure.
No. We'll see what happens afterwards. But JJ, good luck with Star Wars, man.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You don't need our luck.
You don't need our luck. You've got millions and millions of dollars behind you. All right. We're going to be back in just a little bit. We've got our feature presentation segment talking to Mari Ulrich about her work, her writing, her directing, and a short and a full-length feature film that she did concerning bike messengers. And it's really great. We also talked to her a little bit about her time at the Venice Film Festival. She went over to Venice, tried to experience the festival life over there in Venice, and had a little bit of an interesting time. So we'll get into that with her in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGM Plus. I'm Tom.
I'm Connor.
And we'll be back in just a bit. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGM Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. I'm Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we are your hosts for this fine, fine podcast. Right now for our feature presentation segment, we are going to be talking to a Chicago-based writer and director, Mari Ulrich. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Hey, it's fantastic to be here.
She is fresh back from the Venice Film Festival, which is an honor that I think Connor and I could only hope to achieve one day, just to kind of maybe be on the outskirts, hawking, you know, water bottles for a dollar.
Grabbing the chain link fence with our fingers and just sort of peering in through the through the aluminum.
I imagine it would be sort of an Oliver Twist situation, you know, please, sir, can I have a short?
Can I have some shorts?
Can I have
that
some shorts?
Way better than what I was going to say.
So, Mari, you is this your first time going to Venice?
Yes. And my film wasn't in it. I just went as an industry person to meet people.
Excellent.
And just check it out. So, because I had such... I've been to Cannes a couple times, and it's a really fantastic place to meet people. So I thought, well, one of the films that I'm... have in development is set in Italy, so I thought maybe I would meet an Italian producer or something.
There you go.
Or some people that have like Coke production money or something. So I'd never been before. I'd never been to Italy before at all. Don't speak a word of Italian, and had never been to Venice, and I was completely overwhelmed by all of it.
I can only imagine like going into one of the most amazing cities in Europe in the world, and going for one of these big film festivals. Now you mentioned that you've been to Cannes,
yes.
And when you first walked into Venice, did you notice anything different?
They have canals instead
That'll
of
do
streets.
It.
That'll do it. No streets.
Or the festival. I mean, they do have some, but I was staying on in an area called San Marco. I'm sorry, in San Stai, and the festival is on another island called Delito, so you have to take a boat to get there.
So you have to take a ferry.
Multiple boats,
oh my
actually,
God,
to get there.
Sounds magical.
Yeah. It's pretty magical, but it was also, it's just so beautiful that I think I short-circuited my brain a little bit, because it's just like mansions and like decaying beauty and just beauty, 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 and like beautiful gondolas and beautiful taxis and beautiful people wearing smart clothes and just all this amazing beauty, and I just sculptures and like iron fences and flower, I don't know.
And then at night you get to go be a part of your industry,
party.
Take a boat and party and watch other people's
a funny
movies.
Thing about that is so it was kind of a comedy of errors for me, this festival, because for one thing I got there later than I meant to. I delayed my arrival just to be fashionably late. No,
That's cool.
I was shooting some, I was shooting some footage in rural France with a friend, working on an experimental film about driving and roads and stuff.
Okay.
And so we encountered some issues, such as getting lost. And so I decided to like.
Was it that experimental? Were you?
Yeah. We're like, just go with it, man. That's an interesting story too, because like she put the name of the town, castle, wherever we were going in her GPS, but it picked like a hotel called Rocamadour and not the actual town village of Rocamadour. So we drove and drove and drove, and we ended up like, oh hi, it says we're here, we're really 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 not here.
So where's the film festival?
So I decided like, well, we're here and we're shooting this and we might as well take the time to try to get some actual footage. So I put off my arrival in Venice, which was highly anticipated by my one friend who was who was going to be there, but so I missed her completely. And then I got to Venice, and the first day I went to pick up my accreditation, it was like I was late, like 5 minutes late, and I couldn't get it. So I went back the next day, and it was like torrential rain, and everyone was just like huddled under this temporary structure built just for the festival, with where they have like a cafe and stuff, and it was raining so hard that it started to like come in and form puddles. And
oh god, was it outdoors?
No, but it was. I just got stuck outdoors, and I had to duck into this, you know, closest
whatever shelter they
could provide. Yeah, well, it was no hurricane, but it was kind of bad. And then I don't know. I could. So then, like, I was finally like got my credential. I'm ready to participate. I got an. Sorry, it's TMI, but I got like an unexpected period. Hi. When I was wearing my like light jeans, so I had to take care of that. And then I had been using this lotion that was like. I had bought in France because I have really dry skin on my legs, and I was allergic to it, which I didn't know until after using it for like 5 days in a row. My skin exploded, and I was like trying to claw my skin off, and I was like, I can't focus on anything. I have to go to the, whatchamacallit, pharmacy.
Yeah. Oh, man. All of this.
I know. I'm just trying to get to the festival. And then they gave me antihistamine. And then I finally go to see a movie, Marvin, which was spectacular. Mm-hmm. It's a French film, and Isabelle Huppert is in it. And I think it's the only film in competition that was directed by a woman, which is one of the reasons I wanted to see it. I was falling asleep because the antihistamine kicked in, and I was like,
The drowsiness. Yeah. God bless. Well, I mean, with this whole film festival, despite all of these, almost Chaplin-esque sort of problems,
this tragic comedy.
What was the atmosphere of the festival like?
It seemed like a mini Cannes in a way. Like maybe it's. I think it's just because it doesn't have the market aspect, but it has the same. Like it's just really cool that the. Celebrities come up in their little boat on the mini canal, and they land in front of the hotel, and people are like throwing themselves against the fence trying to get autographs and stuff. And it's just like so beautiful, and it's very cool.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
And you did get to see, what was the film called? Marvin. And really the only one directed by a woman?
In competition.
Yeah. Okay.
There were other films directed by women
that were playing there.
But not in competition. Okay. So.
Well, I mean, do you think that was? I mean, I find that a little surprising.
Yeah.
Only one in competition.
Yeah. It's a thing, I guess.
And yeah.
They stand by their decision, but I don't know.
Of course they do.
Yeah.
Of course they do.
We're the Venice Film Festival. We know cinema.
Yeah.
Or how they say it in Italian, it's cinema.
Cinema.
I think that's the best part about it. It's just cinema. There's something special. Yeah, little mic check. All right. So, I mean, would you go back again and hopefully
for
this time?
Sure. And I think part of it, too, is like just trying to figure it out. It's hard to do. It just takes. I remember my first time at Cannes, I felt a little bit like the same, like a little bit overwhelmed by everything. And then you kind of figure out how to do stuff, and it takes less time, and you figure out how to take the water taxi to get there on time and stuff like that. That was the other interesting thing, is that I was going to go to a Production Bridge industry party, and I'm like, finally going to party, put on a little short dress and spent some time on my makeup, and I go out to catch the water taxi, the Vaporetto, and the canal was closed.
How do they close a canal?
Historical regatta.
Oh, well.
Which was fantastic. It was like, and at that point I just laughed, and I was like, okay.
Well, I'm going to watch this regatta.
I'm going to watch the regatta and take some pictures, and then I'll go have dinner and whatever. Well, you just got to like go.
You make
with
the
it.
Best of it.
Yeah.
You make the best of it.
Couldn't you have told the guy to take some like side canals or something?
Yeah.
I did try to hitch a ride with one of the
just
little
hop into another
gondolas.
One.
They were like, it's difficult. It's very difficult. I'm like, oh, okay.
We understand, but you know. I'm trying to rub elbows here. I'm trying to make this work.
So was the Venice Film Festival, was this your first festival that you went to as you were invited as an industry figure?
No, I went to Cannes this year just as an industry person.
Okay.
As well. Right.
Do you have to register and identify yourself as an industry person?
Yeah, and they check, you know, I don't know how closely, but they scrutinize your credentials and make sure you're actually an industry person.
Yeah.
And not just like, you know, random Joe Bob who wants to
go to Cannes.
Or maybe he'll meet some celebrities or something.
All right. Would you be willing to vouch for us if Connor and I were just like,
absolutely.
Please, I've been here before. These guys are the real deal. I promise.
I'll show you the right restaurant.
And please say it like that, too.
Yes.
These guys are the real deal.
Your best 1940s news producer.
Atlantic.
Mid-Atlantic
accent.
Exactly. Well, let's move on to the films that you have made. Connor and I were lucky enough to get to see two of your films, one a short, one a full feature length, both dealing with the same character, the same central character, and that's Faster and The Alley Cat. Both films deal with a cyclist.
Jasper,
yes. Mm-hmm. And she is in Chicago. She's a bike messenger. And both films deal with this situation of her being a bike messenger in two very different ways. So I want to ask first, right off, where did the idea for Jasper as a character come from?
I had that idea for a really long time, like even before I applied to Columbia for the MFA program. I sort of had that character kicking around in my head, although it became much more clear as I was working on my thesis film. And I think it was because I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and we didn't really have bike messengers, especially back then. There just weren't any. And so I went to undergrad in Boston, Massachusetts, and there were bike messengers everywhere. And I was just like, whoa, they're so cool. Because they were kind of like athletes, but punk rock. They were like,
yeah.
You know.
And they're serving a function as well.
They're serving a function. They're like very driven, like intense.
No nonsense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're very driven. They're doing their job. They're obviously good at it, or they wouldn't be able to they'd get run over or something, or not be able to make a living. And so I just found it really intriguing. So I would like kind of like hang out at bike messenger bars and whatever.
Now that's a thing, is a bike messenger bar. How do I get into those bars? Do I need to have a fixie or
no?
Can you vouch for us?
Yeah. These guys are not nerds.
So it seems like you introduce yourself to this culture of the bike messenger to flesh out the character.
Yes, and like I started researching blogs like written by bike messengers and finding old zines and stuff. And just reading more about it, and it kind of like cemented my idea of like, okay, yes, they are super punk rock athletes. And then I just transplanted the story to Chicago and wrote, you know, I originally wanted to make a feature, but you can't for your thesis film. Mm-hmm. It's got to be under however many minutes. So I didn't want to make a piece of it or a trailer. So I just rewrote the story to be a short, and that's how I came up with Faster.
Now, Faster really is, the name really communicates the speed of this film. Like, I remember watching it just being struck by the breakneck feel of the film. You really communicate the feeling of being a bike messenger. Like, you are there with Jasper on this journey, I suppose. and you have some pretty incredible shots of mm-hmm. downtown Chicago. Mm-hmm. How mm-hmm. did you manage to do that? Like, were mm-hmm. you just had the resources doing your thesis through that was through Columbia, correct?
Through Columbia. I'm really glad that you said that because we wanted it to feel like you were kind of on the road with her. And a couple of things. One was I met. So through the blogs, I found this one blog. I think it was called Dispatch 101, written by a former Dispatch bike messenger guy. Julio Saravia, if you're out there listening. And I contacted him eventually, and I was, like, super shy about it. I was like, he's going to think I'm so stupid. He's going to hate my script. But I just was like, I want to make a film about bike messengers, and can you read it and tell me if it's, like, at all realistic? And so he read it, and he really liked it, and he met with me to talk about it, and he was like, let me introduce you to some people. So one of the people was Renee Kudal, who's a bike messenger for many years, and he came and worked on the film. Sometimes we had the camera mounted to him, to his chest for some of the shots. And then so a lot of the other shots, Renee is sort of like... fielding traffic for Jenny Struben, the lead actress. So he's out in front and a little bit to the left, kind of shielding her from traffic. And then she's riding so that we don't see Renee, but we can see Jenny. And then I'm behind driving my old Saab that I had. And the DP, Tony Santiago, is just like hanging out the window.
Wow, that is some guerrilla filming.
Yeah,
seriously. It does blow my mind when I was watching that, just how quickly it went, and then just how you didn't really give it seemed like the characters didn't have a lot of time to like take a breather, they were just going
all happening.
I'd like to refer to it as a brown paper bag movie, because you're just like like, where is this gonna go? Like, you are really, the investment is totally there. With Jasper, you said, played by lead actress Jenny, did she already have biking experience?
Just a little bit, but she actually, I sent her out to train with Renee. And so he took her to work with him for like half a day. And it was so funny because she was like, I died. I was like dying. And he was like, no, she did great. And she was like, I was toast by like 10 a.m.
Oh my gosh.
But so he taught her some like tricks and maneuvers and how to dismount gracefully and stuff mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah, it seems for someone who really has no frame of reference for the bike messenger world, I was convinced. As far as I was concerned, this is how bike messengers operate.
Well, we've both ridden bikes around Chicago, and we know it's a harrowing experience no matter what. You know,
speak for yourselves. I refuse to get on a bike.
Okay.
In Chicago, it gives me the willies, and maybe that's what worked for me. So
sure. Like, I was just feel vulnerable.
Yeah, exactly. With the story itself, there's this kind of thread of Jasper making some pretty hard choices that seem, I guess, on the surface trivial, but at the end of the day are choices that we would all make and maybe have to consider. Could you talk a little bit about the story of Faster?
Well, Jasper, the character Jasper, is kind of... she's trying to put herself through school. I don't know if it is super apparent, but in the opening scene, she's hasn't been able to enroll for her classes, and she's having a talk with an administrator who's just like, well, I don't know. Can you ask your parents for money? And she's just like, see ya. So so she's kind of not making it, and she's having to hustle a little bit. So she's doing some questionable things along the way.
And that's why she takes the big 10-pound mystery package at the
end. And she the box because she's gonna get more money for toting a box. One of my ideas I was playing with in the film was that the street level was sort of hell. Am I allowed to say hell?
Oh yeah, you can say a lot of things.
Okay. So the street level was hell, and the office level was supposed to be like heaven that she couldn't access because she's trapped in hell.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That is... No, and that's totally there,
because
though.
Because of the, yeah, I remember the receptionist gives her, like, the stink eye or whatever. Yes. Like, you're not supposed to be here. You're all sweaty.
The proverbial, is it St. Peter that sits at the pearly gates?
Yeah.
Yes.
I like that.
We have some, like, angel imagery sprinkled throughout. That happens to exist in Chicago. Like, there's a statue of Winged Victory, and a mosaic of angels flying and stuff like that. So
yeah, very carefully chosen shots.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
With the writing process, how quickly did you write it? How did you approach getting this screenplay done?
It took a while. My first draft, I think, was like one page, which is not really a movie yet.
Yeah.
And for a while I had her quitting and just like throwing her, I wanted her to be really super pissed off and just like throw her walkie in the garbage can and be like, I'm done, kind of thing.
Out.
Yeah. And then I just was like, I don't know if I'm happy with that in terms of like what it says about her as a person and stuff. So even though I kind of liked it in that punk rock kind of like nihilistic way, I was like, all right, I got to think of something else.
But Jasper's not a quitter.
She's not a quitter. Yeah. And so it took a while. It took 10, 12, 15-ish revisions to get it where I felt ready to shoot.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's something a lot of people don't realize about film, is that almost any movie you watch has gone through a significant number of revisions.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very rarely ever just, it doesn't just pour out and, you know.
Yeah, perfect form.
Yeah. Even the great Aaron Sorkin does not just, you know, spit out an episode of The West Wing on a whim. He's got to pass that by people and he's got to reconsider it himself. How does it feel to look at something that's completely yours and have to kind of tear it down a little bit?
It's good. So I have my friend Eric Houts has edited. He works at Cutters and he edited Faster and he also edited The Alley Cat. So, and a lot of the pacing and stuff is really his, you know, kudos to him. But I'm really heavily involved in the editing process, sitting with him and, let's try this, let's try that, trying things out and whatnot. But you get to a point where it makes no sense any longer whatsoever. You're watching it and you're like, a complete blank.
You don't recognize the thing that you've written?
You know it so well that it has no meaning anymore.
Yeah, it's just words on a page or images on a screen.
You can't remember what you're going for and whether or not it's working because you just know it too well. And so you got to take some space. And then it helps to have... it always helps to watch it with other people. So have test screenings and bring other people in and you can sort of like feel how they react to stuff. It's really interesting.
And did that have a bearing on the editing process then, those test screenings?
Yeah. Yeah. If people said like, well, I didn't understand this or this part was dragging or something. So, you know, and then it's done and it's out in the world and it's like, woo, festivals and stuff.
I mean, you've mentioned that it's played in quite a few places.
Yeah. Internationally?
Internationally, yeah. It played at one of the first festivals it played at was the BFI London Film Fest.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you manage to get it entered into that? Did you just like, excuse me, British Film Institute, I've got something you might enjoy?
Randomly. Actually, it was, I had taken it to Cannes, the Short Film Corner, which is not part of the official festival. It's part of the market. But so it was in the Short Film Corner and I was trying to find a distributor. And you can, if you're part of the Short Film Corner, you can log into the database and see who's watched your film. And you can see like, oh, this person favorited it. So I would be in touch with those people. Hey, notice you. Look at you checking out my film. Can we talk? And then I just didn't hear anything back, which was disappointing. So then after Cannes was done and people kind of like settled down, you know, get back to normal life. And then I would send a few follow-up emails and kind of wasn't getting anywhere. But I asked a friend of mine, like, okay, these guys over at Shorts International said they favorited my film, but I can't get in touch with them. Who do you talk to over there? And they said, like, oh, I work with Simon. So I sent it to Simon, and I was like, hey, I'm looking for a distributor. I heard you're looking for short films. Here's my movie. And he was like, hey, I really like that. Do you think I could program it in the London Film Festival, too? And I was like,
no.
Let me ask my agent.
vomits into a bag. Yeah. Yeah.
That's, I mean, and it seems like that's the way to be when you are starting out as a filmmaker, and or at least working on this level as a filmmaker, is that you have to be your own biggest fan. You really have
it's
to
tough.
Put yourself out there.
It can be tough. It's actually easier for me when something's done to keep throwing it out there. Like Alley Cat is still screening,
yeah.
even though it's like a couple years old now, but it's like, you know, I realized I had some Spanish subtitles made for a festival, and then like a year ago, and then I realized it really hasn't played anywhere mm-hmm. other than the US, or, you know, so I was like, it's time to send it out internationally. So I've been playing a lot in like South America.
I think you mentioned Ecuador, right, when we screened it,
yes.
or when you screened it at,
yes.
at Cinema Obscura.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I did have a question. So you created the Faster short as your thesis film mm-hmm. through the program at Columbia. What was it like? Could you tell us a little bit about the process from making a short film into making a feature? And then also, you're out of school at that point, and you, the onus of responsibility and the onus of even being able to create this feature-length film, which I can only imagine is much more stressful and difficult. Could you tell us a little bit about that transition and just the difficulties or the just the things that you learned about
there
that?
There were some dark days. There were some dark days because I was like out of school, so like no more cushy student loan money. And I was like teaching adjunct, so I was getting paid peanuts. And I was like doing transcriptions on the side for some company, like video company. And I was trying to, I'd gotten a job in Michigan teaching film like full time, tenure track. And I knew I was leaving Chicago, and I remember like driving around with my friend Hannah and saying like, I really, really want to make a feature film in Chicago before I leave. And she's like, oh, cool. So you have a budget? And I was like, well, well, no. Like,
no.
Oh, so you have a script? And I was like, well,
no.
Well, no. I'm going to get on that. It was really hard. I have the hardest time like staying not motivated, but like just not exquisitely depressed during the creative process, because it's like, this is never going to get made. No one's ever going to. Why am I bothering? Like, and I would. I was really stuck also because I didn't want to remake Faster but Longer. Mm-hmm. I had kind of told that story, and I wanted to do something else.
And you didn't.
And right,
you did not.
I did not at all. But it took a while to figure out what is it that I'm still, like, I was still really attached to this character, and I felt like I still have something to explore with her, but I was like, I'm not exactly sure where it's going. And then I had met Dylan Varecchia. He's the DP for the Alley Cat at a film festival. And he just was like, yeah, let's shoot your movie whenever you get a budget. So I would run ideas past him, and he was like a really big help to me when I was like in the depression of like, nothing's happening. And he would be like, okay, why don't you go out and volunteer at one of these Alley Cats? Why don't you go out and meet some people and feel like you're doing stuff? Mm-hmm. And it was really good advice because I met more people, I got more research done, you know, and it helped me stay, feel like I was doing something instead of just like, I'm typing.
Moving beyond the typewriter.
Yeah.
What I really enjoyed was watching Faster and then the Alley Cat back to back, because not only is it a continuation of the character, but also a little bit deeper exploration. You get introduced in Faster, and then you get to immediately go deeper. And something I noticed was the theme of day and night. Faster taking place all during the day in the brightness of Chicago with this fast-paced editing and fast-paced storytelling. And then we get to the Alley Cat, and it's night, and all the shots are beautiful in this nighttime. Things are shrouded, but you still have these city lights, and it really lent itself to this kind of darker exploration of this character. So can you tell me a little bit, did you plan on shooting it all at night?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. You knew that you were going to go nighttime with this one.
Yeah. And I'm like kind of a morning person, and after a certain point, my brain just shuts off. So it was really hard. Even the night before, Dylan was like, are you sure this has to happen overnight? I'm like, yeah. But it really did, because I wanted the the morning to come. Like, I wanted it all to take place over one night, and then the end would be when the sun rises. So it was very intentional. I kind of liked that idea of going into that liminal space where things are kind of undefined and strange, and you don't really know necessarily where she's going or why or what's happening, but it seems kind of important to her.
Absolutely.
And just sort of like the creatures of the night come out that she interacts with.
Oh yeah.
So that was my idea. And some of those interactions are like actually things that have happened to me, but I've just transposed them onto her for this film, like not all at once, obviously, but and thinking about it is a little bit of a love letter to Chicago, and thinking that sometimes random interactions can be really horrible, but they can also be really beautiful.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the love letter, I think that definitely comes through with the setting in Chicago. It was really fantastic to see a movie set in Chicago where Chicago was allowed to be itself. Like,
yeah.
You saw places, even like specifically that diner scene. I've been past that diner a million times, and the minute I saw it, I was like, I know where this is. And places like that that aren't recognizable to everybody, but recognizable to some, and when people see it, they know, they're like, this seems like a place where that people would know and people would actually go to. I think that really worked in the favor of giving Jasper a place to be in.
Cool, thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about picking those locations in Chicago?
Yeah, some I had in mind from the very beginning. Like, there's a very quick moment at the very end where she's riding towards the lake and you go under one of the overpasses and there's a mosaic. And I don't know if it's Foster Avenue anymore. I can't remember. But she goes under one of those overpasses. And I called it the sparkly thing because it's like mirrored. Some of the mosaic tiles are mirrors. Mm-hmm. And it was really important to me that she go through there on her way to the lakefront. The lakefront was, really important that she's looking back at the city. And then the diner and the park are things that are very Chicago. And one of the other things I was really set on was there's like this little banana tree parking lot somewhere down here. I'm forgetting the street it's on. It's either like Clark or Dearborn or something. It's random. It's completely random, but I really, really wanted it.
Look
and
for the bananas.
The banana. That's where they do the fruit stand station early on in the Alley Cat.
Right.
And it might be hard to make out, but there's like little plastic banana trees over the parking lot.
Okay.
So some of them I knew already that I wanted, and some were just driving around looking for good places. Like, where's a really good place to have a one of these stations that's accessible by bike, that looks interesting, and that is kind of a little different from the other stuff we've seen, hopefully. I also really wanted to be down in the like lower Wacker and lower, and we shot some scenes really close to here, across from the Billy Goat.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah.
It is crazy watching the specifically the Alley Cat at
going
night.
Like, oh, I know where that is.
Yeah, exactly.
I've
yeah.
been down this road.
Of course, I have never seen nobody get on that road before. So going from the pace that you establish in Faster, it's bright. It's really, as Tom said, it's breakneck. And then you get to the Alley Cat, and it is nighttime. And the pace is still definitely there. The remnants of that, you know, the energy are there. But then due to some of the events mm-hmm. in the film, it really slows down and opens up the vulnerabilities of Jasper. So I guess in under like 90 minutes, I think, for both of them,
mm-hmm.
I really feel like you fleshed out Jasper as a character. So I was curious, though, is there anything on the horizon for Jasper, or are you?
I don't think so. I've got a bunch of other stuff I'm working on, and she hasn't appeared in any of it, but not to say that she could never mm-hmm. reappear. I found her like to be a really interesting character because each time I did a character biography for her, and they were a little bit different between Faster and then the Alley Cat, And of course, also that some time has passed and some other things have happened in her life between those two films. So like things have gotten a little worse.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Hopefully. I would love to see Jasper again, but cool. When the time is right.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you feel that Jasper is ready to return, Jasper shall return.
Cool.
Now, both of these films are available on Amazon Prime and Amazon in general.
Yes, and I think they're both on iTunes still, and The Alley Cat is also on YouTube Rentals.
Excellent. So it's, I wanted to know, and I've asked a few of other filmmakers that we've spoken to on the show about this kind of digital distribution model where you can widen your audience, but under the fear of maybe getting buried a little bit under the deluge of content. How are your feelings? What are your feelings on this kind of new frontier of digital distribution?
I think my dream has always been to have a theatrical release, which I didn't quite achieve this time. But I think I sort of fell into a little bit of a gap because I went with Gravitas Ventures. Mm-hmm. They're my distributor. And I really like them, but I came in, or they released the film at a time when the person I was working with was leaving the company. So I felt like there wasn't a whole lot of promotion around it. That I was kind of sort of expecting.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do yourself. Like, I try.
Yeah,
but
there's only so much you can do as a single person.
Yeah, I might not be the best person to, like, do marketing at.
Right.
So
they have professionals for this.
Yeah, yeah. however, it's been interesting that, like, people find it, you know, not necessarily just people I know. But
there's a life there for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's nice to know that even as someone who's watched it, you know, if someone was just like, oh, you know, do you have any film recommendations? I was like, well, if you got 15 minutes, you know, you got a little bit, watch faster. And they don't have to worry about like, well, am I going to be able to find it? Where is it? Do I have to rent it? It's right there. And
true.
you can just recommend that thing to everybody. But I'm always curious about digital distribution. I mean, Connor, how much do you go on streaming services and be like, I can't find anything, even though there's so much
on a daily basis?
Yeah.
And I find too that like some of the big services like Netflix, people are so into the series that they might not be looking, like people are watching the stuff that everyone's talking about. They might not be out there looking for the little stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's there, people. It's there.
And you need to find it.
Yes. Yeah. They're making it available to you.
Yep.
Mari is making this available to you. Watch it.
Are there a lot of TV shows? Yes. Do you have to watch them all? Yes. <Get started. laughs>
But you got an extra 60 minutes to watch The Alley Cat.
Absolutely. So what's coming up on the horizon just in general for you?
Well, I have several feature films in development that I would like to get made, and I'm sort of trying not to be too chaotic about it, but working on them all and seeing which one, you know, sticks.
Sounds inherent.
So,
a little chaos.
Yeah. Because one of them, so, and interestingly, too, they're not about bicycles, but they're all connected to travel in a way. So one of them that seems like it might be the most accessible, ready to go in a way, sans budget, is a really dark road trip film. It's like a psychological horror film, and the lead character is in her 40s, and she's off on this road trip by herself in a camper, like, woo, you go, girl.
I'm listening.
Yeah. But then there's like a very dark side, which I won't talk about, because I don't know how much to reveal or not reveal.
Yeah, tell us what you can, you know?
Yeah, you can feel free to keep the secret. You already have us enticed because, one, you're making a movie. All right, cool. We want to watch it. So you can keep that in the puzzle box. You can wait.
Yeah, I'll just say that she's on this road trip cross country in her mini bago, and like her social media is impeccable, like doing yoga in front of the natural vistas and stuff like that, and has a big following, but her interior life is like, whoa.
Something else.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Whoa.
Crumbling.
And then I have another film that was written by a friend of mine, Gisela Faggi, it's called The Infected, and it's about an Eritrean refugee, who lands in Italy, and she's trying to make her way to Sweden to her family. And so it's by foot, it's by bus, it's by train, you know, it's however she can get there. And she's just meets with a lot of hardship along the way. And that is compounded by a new virus that's infecting specifically the refugees. It starts in a refugee camp, but now it's spreading. So they face not only the usual kind of go home, get out of our country right. kind of feeling, but now actual fear and like real hatred of
they'd
be killed.
It starts at the outset of the infection. That's interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I feel like most movies deal with that after it's been given some chance to spread out.
No, it's like just sort of just happening.
It's happening.
Interesting.
It's happening. I like that. I like that a lot.
Thank you. Then I have my road trip through France.
It's your like experimental a film.
Experimental film.
Where
essay,
you are.
Experimental doc essay film / essay film, which is all about driving. And some of the footage I've shot in Nashville, which is where I'm from. And there's more I need to shoot in Chicago and around the area. And I'm not exactly sure how it's going to come together. I have ideas, but it's going to be a process of editing, recording stuff, and seeing how it goes, how it flows. And then I also have a rom-trage.
A rom-trage.
Rom-trage.
It's like a romantic comedy, but it ends very poorly.
Nice.
That's fun to say.
Finally.
Rom-trage. Yeah. And that one's like sort of like the most Hollywood, I guess, of the films. But I am in the very beginning stages of developing, so I'm just at the outline stage for that one. But
all right,
so you have four projects, four coming up,
four top class A plus projects. I'm very excited. I just love looking towards the future, especially when it's a filmmaker who has already done great stuff, and
aww.
We just want to see what comes. So promise
cool.
You will let us know.
I will
when things start happening because we want to talk about it. We want to
let you know when I'm begging for money. Maybe I should beg for money now. That's the only thing that stands between me and making another film.
Well, yeah, and that's always what it is. It's budget, and it's hard to keep that going at the rate you need to, because as much as filmmaking has been democratized and it's easier than ever, but there's still that gate there of you need to have a budget.
Yeah.
You know, people want to get paid to do their art, and while that is, you know, that's totally just as much as you should be paid to do your art, it's difficult to get that all together. So best of luck.
Yeah.
Truly.
Thank you very much. I'll probably do a Kickstarter soon-ish.
Boom. And she will let us know when that goes up, and we will share that with all of you here on No Coast Cinema. Mari, thank you so much for coming on the program. Writer, director, Mari Ulrich. Is there anywhere we can follow you on social media where listeners can come and find your work?
The Alley Cat Film has a website. And my production company is called EconoProd, which we're also on Facebook, as in economical production.
It's got to give me, I wish I had a bell.
Ding, ding.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Mari. We will we'll talk to you soon. Stay up to date with that. We're going to be back in just a bit here on No Coast Cinema. I'm Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And there's plenty more show coming, so stick around. Welcome back, everybody. No Coast Cinema here on WGM Plus. Thank you so much to Mari Ulrich for sitting down with Connor and I. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I really love Mari. So glad that we managed to get to see those films at Cinema Obscura, run by our good friend John Davies.
Shout out to John.
Shout out to John. And we hope that you will check it out too. Remember that you can watch both Faster and The Alley Cat over on Amazon. You can do a regular rental, or if you have Amazon Prime, you can watch them as part of your Amazon Prime subscription, which is totally awesome. Fantastic. And shout out to streaming services everywhere. Unless you're a writer for Newsweek.
Unless you're Zachary Schoenfeld. Zachary Schoenfeld.
The arbiter of destruction.
The arbiter of online streaming curation.
Whoa! Okay, so there is this Newsweek article that both Connor and I found very interesting. This is from September 15th, and the title is Netflix Streaming Video and the Slow Death of the Classic Film. Basically, what Mr. Schoenfeld argues here is that Netflix and most streaming services, for that matter, have a significant lack of what we would consider classic film. So he defines this as movies before 1960. He uses the anecdote of the release of Psycho in 1960 as his starting point.
And he does make an interesting point.
He does. He does. There is not a lot of film on Netflix that predates 1960. I would say 1960 is the year that, like, I don't know, I feel like a lot of pop culture movies really started there. Like, Psycho is more than just a film classic. It's like a pop culture icon. Like, the shower scene, you know, dressing up as the, like, they made Bates Motel. They made an entire series about it. So it I think it is an interesting starting point for that. However, I would kind of want to argue against what Zachary is saying here in terms of classic films. Like, do you watch a lot of classic films on Netflix?
Not on Netflix, no. The thing about Netflix is I'm not going to go there for old films. There are streaming services out there which curate it much better than Netflix ever could. And films like that shouldn't have to be put into competition with things like Ozarks or, you know, Netflix original series. Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho should not be, you know, I just don't think that it needs to be buried in all of the stuff that Netflix has on the dreck that Netflix has there.
Well, what I think what he's trying to get at is that, like, maybe it should, like, maybe Netflix can up their selection if they add a little bit more classic movies. But, you know, as he mentions in his own article, there's the question of, you know, rights of copyright, and you need to pay to have those streaming rights. And frankly, those can be expensive.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'd be wrong to say that you can just get those. And I think he makes that concession that you need to pay for those. He quotes someone here. I believe they're reading of the market. And you can tell they're talking to a classic film person because they use a word like vicissitudes. I don't vicissitudes. I don't really know. Of acquiring materials from the studio's film libraries are key factors, meaning basically getting the rights for these films is a little bit difficult. And Netflix has determined for them, for their business and for the audience, that they're not really that interested in having those classic films, which, on a greater level, is a little disappointing. You meet a lot of people. I've spoken to people that say they will not watch any movies made before, like, 1990.
Really?
Yeah. They're just like, no, they're old and they're stupid.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like, they don't have CGI and shit, which is weird.
Well, that's one end of the spectrum, and then it seems as though Schoenfeld is on the other end, where he's saying,
like, I want to watch all this.
Yeah, I want... I've scrolled through Netflix 100 times. I see Moana and An American Tale on here, but where's the Kurosawa? It's like, come on.
And to that point, there is Kurosawa on Netflix. I actually have right in front of me, if you go to the Classic Movies tab, which is like, if you use the Genres tab, Classic Movies is on there. And there's a fair amount of what we would consider classics. Now, they're not all from before 1960, but I guess you would call them classics. For Kurosawa, they've got Kagamusha, which is a fantastic film. One of his later films, it's not, you know, Sanjuro, it's not Seven Samurai, but it's there. Sunset Boulevard, classic, stone cold classic. I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeVille. Like, you got Metropolis, Fritz Lang's Metropolis, one of the most landmark moments in film history. The original The Fly. Now, it does get into stuff like Patton, which is from the 70s, Grease, Jaws, The Shining, Young Frankenstein. But those count,
absolutely.
I think. I mean, they're more recent, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, I'm sorry they don't have Chaplin. They don't have any – they don't have City Lights. They don't have, you know, any of those classic – they don't have Buster Keaton. They don't have Spartacus, you know. I don't know what to tell you.
It's
those
sort of like
expensive.
It's sort of like square peg, round hole kind of a situation because
right.
He's looking at this and he's like, why? He's looking at this square hole and he's like, why aren't you a circle? It seems as though he is trying to hold Netflix to a standard that maybe their business model has never been, that maybe that's just never been a part of their goal.
Yeah, they are all about bingeability. I feel like they've even moved on realistically from movies being the main thing for them.
Oh yeah,
it really it's all about streaming series. It's all about bingeable TV. You know, they really kicked off a lot of that with House of Cards. And House of Cards was massive. I think a lot of people forget now how massive House of Cards was when that first came out. And they even brought, I mean, David Fincher was involved with that. Like, television, like, streaming series has become streaming's bread and butter because it keeps people hooked, keeps people hardcore hooked. Movies are nice to have, but streaming services are really not about the movies right now. And the movies that they do have, they want to keep it current and want to keep them like super popular. Do I necessarily agree with that? I mean, it's what you make of it.
It would be nice if Netflix was this sort of utopian all-in-one streaming service where it offered all of these classic films. But if that's something that you really care about and something that you are, you know, looking for in your media stream, there are sites out there. I know, Tom, that you use plenty of things that offer just that.
Yeah. I pay for Filmstruck, which is run by the Criterion Collection and Turner Classic Movies. And even Turner Classic Movies, I think, might have another thing that's just for Turner. And I get tons of classic movies. And, yes, it's extra. Like, you're paying an extra $8 to $10 a month to get these classic movies. But like, you can't expect one streaming service for realistically the insane price of $10 a month. You get literally hundreds of thousands of hours of content. I'm sorry that it doesn't have everything. One of the sadder moments for me, I know Hulu used to have exclusive access to the Criterion Collection, a selected number of titles, but, you know, the Criterion Collection nonetheless, and they had a lot of classic films. That changed when Criterion wanted to strike out and do their own kind of niche streaming service. But you can go on Hulu. You can still watch a lot of classic stuff, mostly television shows. You've got The Twilight Zone. You've got Star Trek. Both the next generation, every type of Star Trek there is, the best kind of Treks, the Star Treks. They've got the Indiana Jones films, which I know Netflix wishes they could have, honestly. But, you know, I feel like this is just a circular thing. At the end of the day, you can criticize the selection all you want, but you're getting so much content for such a little price. There's only so much stuff that they can bring on, and only so much stuff that studios are willing to license out. As you saw with Disney, they're like, "Oh, we want a slice of the streaming pie. Why would we give you all this business when we can get it for ourselves?"
Yeah, and they are going to be moving forward with that in the next couple of years.
Yeah, unfortunate, but you know, I still buy shit. I still buy hard copies of things for exactly this reason. I've had to justify this to some people where they're just like, well, why don't you just rent it, or why don't you just, like, you know, stream it or something like that? And I'm like, well, because I like, you know, one of them is just like kind of the fetish property of it, where it's just like, I like to have it. I like having the physical copy. But it also means that I have unstoppable access to this, as long as I have my Blu-ray player and a television, I can watch this movie as many times as I want.
It's a comforting feeling.
Yeah, and it's not limited to my internet connection. I can just play it. But I'm a little bit of an old fogey when it comes to these sorts of things. I like to have the physical media.
That's Tom, the collector.
The collector.
That's why they call him the collector.
Yeah. For those of you who have seen The Collector, I am The Collector. Oh. I killed those teens.
On-air confession.
Yes. I do want to cap it off here with just a quick little discussion.
You don't want to scream into the void anymore?
No.
Oh, we're not doing
I've had my daily allotment of screaming into the void.
Oh, okay.
I know. We can do a little bit later.
All right.
I got to recharge, and I got to kind of like recenter myself looking into the dark void of nothingness. And
That is Netflix's streaming curation.
So we want to just touch on some of the things that we've been streaming and watching and trying to catch up on. Connor, what have you been watching?
So South Park is back, and so is Nathan For You. Been watching a decent amount of Comedy Central lately, I suppose. I also rewatched Baby Driver, which I have. It's definitely colored my opinion of the movie.
Yeah, how has it changed?
So I'm a huge Edgar Wright fan. I am a big fan of the brand of comedy that he has, but I also am sort of seeing these enduring themes in his movies, which I don't think are going to age well, and I particularly with me, I don't know. There's this sort of male driven aspect to his movies. Obviously, I mean, there a lot of them are buddy movies, but in Baby Driver specifically, we talked about this a little bit in previous episodes. But the female character gets absolutely sidelined, and having noticed that in Baby Driver, I go back to the other movies, and it's just hard for me to not see it in the other movies as well.
Yeah,
just the way that he places the emphasis on the male hero is strange to me.
Yeah, luckily for me, I would say Shaun of the Dead. I think absolutely a lot of his movies do have that inherent super male mentality, and I think it works best. My favorite movie he's ever made is Hot Fuzz, because it plays against these male stereotypes and explores male relationships in a fun way. It's not about like men being like, you know, over women, I guess. It's just like, okay, we're gonna look at male relationships.
Yeah.
Like, but you know, it's a subtle dig at the buddy cop movie, and it's got a lot of heart to it. Shaun of the Dead luckily is clever enough to get around a little bit of its female character problems. Like Liz as a character in Shaun of the Dead, she's got some good bits.
Oh yeah.
And I think there's more of an interesting dynamic there, which is sad to see it not in Baby Driver, because we know that he knows how to write relationships with Sean and Liz in Shaun of the Dead. It's complicated. It's a complicated relationship, and she dumps him. Like, she's just like, I'm not going to put up with you being a man child. And like, you see growth in him and see how the relationship grows. And there's also his issues with his mom and his stepdad. So it feels like you're watching a real person. Baby Driver, as you said, female character is sidelined, and she is just an object.
Yeah. Protected and ferried around.
Exactly. I knew nothing about that character.
No.
By the end of it. I can't even remember. Wasn't it it starts with a D.
Her name?
Yeah.
Deborah,
that's it, because of the Beck song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Deborah. Isn't that sad that, like, I'm not even thinking, like, what's her name?
I was watching it with some people, and they were just like, how many times did they meet? Three times?
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden he's like killing a John Hamm for her?
Killing a John Hamm.
Killing a whole John Hamm.
I'm going to kill that Hamm, that John Hamm. For Debbie. Debs.
I'm coming to get you, Barbara.
Yeah. It's I think Edgar Wright maybe needs to take a look at how he's writing his characters. That's not to say that we don't like Baby Driver.
No,
I like Baby Driver. It's just like,
it's a great action movie.
Yeah. It's just like, it's not, it could go a little bit further. It could have just been better. It goes from being a good action movie. It could have been a great action movie.
Yes.
If they had just really taken a little bit more time explaining the characters, you know, instead of, focusing so much on the action. But, you know, maybe if they didn't focus so much on the action, the set pieces wouldn't be so good. So that's interesting to think about. Baby yeah. Driver, will it hold up?
I don't know.
I myself have been trying to... I've never really been a huge fan of DC's on-screen presence, DC Comics.
In terms of their cinematic universe, or...
I mean, I like the Dark Knight trilogy. I think those are really good, but obviously they've been kind of striking out a lot, save for Wonder Woman. Their animated films have always been really good. They've had a strangely great animated presence compared to everything else they've done.
Yes.
But I know that they have, for a long time, had been doing live-action series on the CW. And I recently decided, on the recommendation of my friend Luke, to try and get into Arrow and The Flash.
Okay.
Which I've just watched the pilot of both, and I definitely came out on the side of Arrow. Arrow debuted in 2012.
Yeah.
And I'm really catching up here. There's 5 seasons of it. Flash is 3 seasons in, I think.
Okay.
So I'm really playing catch up here. And I definitely came out on the side of Arrow first because it was more cohesive of a pilot. I get the Flash pilot, you know, pardon the pun, was a little bit fast-paced for me.
Mm.
It moved on a little bit too quickly, and I felt smoothed over a lot of things. But luckily, talking to Luke, he explained to me that Flash got, like, a weird backdoor pilot in season 2 of Arrow, which, like, sets a lot of things up that the actual pilot for The Flash kind of just smooths over because they assume that you know this. Or maybe they tried to strike a balance of, like, casual viewer and people who have already seen Arrow. So I'm surprised, though. I'm surprised at how much I enjoyed both of them. They're both very, I don't know, typical TV shows, though. They're very traditional in their sense of humor. There's nothing really that... They're not, like, subversive or anything. They're not particularly well, like, directed.
Relatively lighthearted and as
yeah.
compared to their big, like, tentpoles.
Yeah. Arrow is, like, definitely the... It's definitely playing off the whole Dark Knight thing. They're just,
Oliver Queen. Yeah. He's got a past, man. He's got a past. He's got a backstory.
And it's tragic.
It's tragic. But and he kills people. He kills the f*** out of people. Like
he's good at it.
Yeah, he shoots the shit out of people with those arrows, and it's pretty cool. Like there's some pretty great action set pieces. Flash is definitely the less grounded of the two, because you know we're talking about all. You know, Green Arrow doesn't have like superpowers. He's just really good at shooting people with arrows. He's just really good at murder.
Being stranded on a deserted island
months. Which they don't, not just months, years.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
there for 5 years with no real indication that he would have the survival skills. Although they, I guess they do tease Deathstroke, and I'm guessing that is the explanation of how he survived is like Deathstroke is an assassin in the DC universe, and he's like, I'm gonna teach you how to kill this motherfucking squirrel.
Okay. All right.
Side note, Deadpool is actually a parody of Deathstroke.
Really?
Yeah.
Is that how he started?
Yeah, because Deathstroke's real name is Slade Wilson.
No way.
And Deadpool is Wade Wilson.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So anyway, that trivia aside, they're interesting. I think if you're into superheroes, they're worth trying to get into, but they're not like cool. You need to kind of put cool out of your mind and just be willing to be entertained, and I think you'll enjoy them.
Is it good TV, Tom?
Is it good TV? I don't really know what good TV is anymore. 'Cause there are so many shows to watch. I'm not, you know, even supposedly good TV is no longer really, you know, has done some bad TV. Like Game of Thrones, I would say, is generally like great TV.
Yeah.
That's great television. It elevates the form. But this past season has been like,
yeah.
I liked it. I was entertained by it. And I feel like they made a lot of those choices to, you know, just kind of move the story along. They're like, we need to set everything up for this final season of just a gangbang of just so many stories finally coming together.
Game of Thrones is kind of crazy, a crazy example to think about, because it seems like it's too big to fail at this point. And it's not going to stop being this extravagant spectacle.
Exactly.
But the writing is only going to keep suffering, I think.
Yeah, they really have painted themselves into a corner of sorts of, like, they need to really pay off a lot of stuff. And that's not to say that George R. R. Martin definitely is not afraid to not pay off a character. He'll set up a character and then just do nothing with it. Like, that's it. Like, he'll just introduce a character. You think that maybe they'll be important later. Nope. Which is fine. I mean, there's no problem with that. I think it's an interesting way of storytelling. But I think, to Game of Thrones' credit, like, seriously, name a show since Game of Thrones that really captured the zeitgeist, that was really centerpiece television. Maybe Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
All right. Any closing thoughts, Connor?
I just watched Jaws, and Steven Spielberg kills off a kid.
Oh, yeah.
And that will never not be jarring.
No.
And that is something that I just wanted to share with you.
Jaws is still one of those movies. It gets me every time. I am enthralled by Jaws every time I watch it.
Yeah,
it's in my top 10. It's in my top 10 greatest movies ever made.
Quinn is just such an entertaining madman.
He got black eyes. I got like a doll's eyes. Another thing about a shark. 40 men go in. How many? Wait, what's the math?
Wait, hold on. What's the math there?
Six. How many times?
He was way more self-assured than this, Tom.
Yeah, I know. Telling the true story of the USS Philadelphia.
Indianapolis.
I think there needs to be a cut of Jaws where, as he's telling the story, we suddenly get to watch
50, all of USS Indianapolis.
Starring Nick Cage.
Yes!
Just cut that in. And then it comes back to Jaws once that's done, and then you get to watch the rest of Jaws. Wow. Spielberg, let us know.
We know how to use iMovie.
Yeah.
You just give us those prints, babe.
Give us the prints. All right. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us for another episode of No Coast Cinema. We're going to be back next week. It's going to be great. We love you all. Don't forget, go on to Apple Podcasts. If you like the show, please give us a rating. Subscribe. It helps everybody find the show on Apple Podcasts, or you can download the WGM Plus app. Fantastic app, and it's not just for us. You can catch so many great shows here on WGM Plus. You just gotta find it. They got Rebel Force Radio, one of the best Star Wars podcasts out there. You got Sound Sessions, fantastic music podcast. They talk to a lot of great musicians. I know they Mike Heidemann, one of the hosts, was recently at Riot Fest. So definitely follow up with them. And you can also find us on WGNradio.com. And if you're on social media, please give us a like over at Facebook.com/NoCoastCinemaPodcast or follow us on Twitter @NoCoastCinema. Thank you, Connor.
Thank you, Tom.
This has been No Coast Cinema, your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago and all around the world. We will see you next week. Yeah, he shoots the shit out of people with those arrows, and it's pretty cool.